Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to the workshop, which I'm greatly enjoying. And I think we already had really great talks where I learned a lot. So title of my talk is kind of the point where I'm heading to at the end. Empirical estimates of STRFs or STRFs are influenced by higher order stimulus statistics. But let me back up a little bit first. Oh, before I forget, yeah, I have to say people who participated in this is Arne Meyer, a PhD student who worked on estimation for receptive field data, Nico Moritz on speech data, Jan-Philipp Diepenbrock and Frank Ohl, who are actually biologists with whom we collaborated in order to get experimental data. So let me for a second give you the broader picture we are interested in, because it's we are not really focused in my group on a single topic, but it's more methods centered. So listening in acoustic scenes, one of our main toys is our hearing aids, small portable microphones that can move quickly, and kind of we want to mimic what the auditory system is doing and find out how the auditory system is, for example, orienting itself in natural environments. So natural environments are really important for us, be it traffic or be it in a pedestrian zone. And yeah, you all know you have this cocktail party problem or sudden burst of attention where something suddenly appears and immediately the auditory system within a couple of few hundreds milliseconds orients towards the stimulus, localizes it, classifies it. How does it do that? We are approaching this from two sides, both from the applied side and from the really fundamental, maybe neurobiology side, if you wish. And today I want to talk about biological data, spectrotemporal properties that we find or try to analyze in the auditory system, putting together, of course, audio data, biological data, and then combine that with our kind of expertise in signal processing, statistics, machine learning, in order to identify those properties. And tomorrow, I will move a bit more to the application side and talk about the spatial audio processing stream briefly that will be targeted more towards localizing where an event is taking place. So today I'll focus on spectrotemporal data, receptive fields. It's kind of funny that I'm giving this quote-unquote tutorial, because there are and there have been quite a big number of people who would be well or even certainly better qualified to do this than me. But yeah, maybe it's good to have this from the more theoretical point of view, because we are not doing experiments anyway. And as I said, I will first do the tutorial part and then head towards what our point, our statement, so to speak, is. So the historical approach to neuronal response characterization, the really historical old method, is tuning curves. You just present your experimental system with a number of stimuli, qualitatively different, and then measure just the strength of the response. And of course, you have to have these stimuli separated like sinusoids with different frequencies. Or you could say, what are the important sounds? So you would like to use natural stimuli, vocalizations, and then record the strength of the response for qualitatively different types of, say, vocalizations, white noise, compound tones, and try different qualitatively different parts. What we want to do is a more specific characterization in terms of a little bit more model-oriented and not such simple or such potentially very complex stimuli, but really something controlled. So the classic work here is, of course, that of Hubel and Wiesel, who showed with these really nice, experiments the response characteristics in the visual field, that only bars oriented in a certain direction elicit a significant number of spike trains, whereas bars in other directions at other locations don't. But this is not, this is showing that there is something like a receptive field, but it's not really probing the system with the stimuli that we are interested in. These are, in a way, you could say, these are still, this is still the method of tuning curves. You vary your stimulus parametrically and obtain the response characteristics, albeit more complex responses with excitatory and inhibitory components. What we really want to do, of course, is working on natural stimuli, ideally using any arbitrary complex occurring stimulus from the real environment of our subject, simultaneously record the responses in whichever way, invasively, imaging modalities, whatever, and kind of build a model, ideally a probabilistic model, that connects our stimulus S to our response R. And where do we start? So let's back up and go really through the steps of how the current methods of STRF estimation have developed. What do we do first? Well, we start linear, right? Basically also based on the works of Hubel and Wiesel, where we have excitatory and inhibitory parts, which give rise to the suggestion, why not just use a very simple linear threshold neuron model where inputs or sensory data, here xj, is weighted with some scalar factors, maybe some threshold, and in the end we calculate a nonlinear function that gives us the output strength, the spike rate, for example. Which stimuli do we want to use? People first used, of course, white noise stimuli, easy to generate, both for analyzing optical responses to optical, to visual stimuli from the retina. So there we have our checkerboard patterns, and as far as I understand, they are still used in vision research, where we could have black-white patterns also developing across time, and simultaneously record the corresponding spike train of some retinal ganglion neuron or B1 neuron, whatever, and then compute a spatiotemporal receptive field. In the auditory cortex, the corresponding thing to the checkerboard might be so-called random chords, which are just tone bursts at different frequencies that occur randomly. And simultaneously, again, record your spike train, compute your spectrotemporal receptive field. Maybe the DRCs, the random chords, are not really that similar to the checkerboards, because the checkerboard patterns are really good in driving visual neurons, whereas these small randomly distributed tones are, at least to our experience from what we learned, not that good in driving neurons. So it looks similar, but maybe in terms of how sensitive the neuron is in the auditory system, it's not really comparable that well to its relevance in the visual domain. Okay, so let's briefly look at how will we estimate receptive field data from spike trains and the stimuli. Well, what we do is we view our stimuli as small patches developing across time, and look at each of these stimulus examples as just a high-dimensional point, or one point in a high-dimensional space. So you could take all these pictures from one patch, gather them in one high-dimensional vector and plot them at one point in space. And if you do this in just two dimensions, stimulus dimension one, stimulus dimension two, there are more, a bit hard to draw, of course, you will get scatter plots. Scatter plots where each of these little stimulus frames corresponds to a single point in that high-dimensional space or two-dimensional plane here. And since we have the response information about spike generating, not spike generating, we can just color them into black dots, which correspond to all the small patches of the stimulus that did not elicit a spike. And the white dots here, that are those patches that did elicit a spike subsequently. And it basically has to be the case that these two distributions of stimuli are somewhat spatially separated in this high-dimensional space. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any statistical difference. So why would there be a spike or not? And what the simplest model of receptive field estimation, the spike-triggered average, is doing, it's just computing the mean or the expectation value of these two ensembles or these two classes of stimuli. Here would be the mean value of all our examples of non-spike eliciting data points, whereas at the center, at the tip of the arrow here, would be the mean of all the white points that did elicit a spike. And this arrow, if you transform it back from this high-dimensional vector that it is into our stimulus space, is nothing else but our receptive field. The spike-triggered average estimate of the receptive field.
Or like this window you select to determine this plot depth.
When we use this so this is, so to speak, it doesn't matter whether it's auditory, visual, it's just a general thinking, right? But if we say this is frequency axis and this is time, then we would usually consider temporal context 200 to 500 milliseconds on the order, but we'll get to those. Next plot, here we already have some examples. So these are derived in A1 with these dynamic random chords. Spike time would be zero, and negative time to the left is the stimulus part prior to a spike, and to the right is after a spike. Of course, if things are causal, anything that comes after the spike should not influence the spike. So anything to the right of the zero should be zero and is. What we see here is that we have a small latency, like 50 milliseconds in many cases, or a bit less, and a temporal extent that can go well towards 150 milliseconds, maybe even more prior to a spike. And we can see some patterns, like here you see a spectral peak like on here, and inhibitory sidebands here and there. Similar to here. Here you seem to see quite a strong structure of excitation and inhibitory components. You might even see some spectrotemporal diagonal transients, like here. We'll come back to that. Yes?
What's the time scale of the? This is the random chords.
These are the random chords from.
How fast do they change?
These were. What was the time binning here? I assume on the 10 milliseconds time scale. Okay, so these are compatible, so to speak, with Hubel and Wiesel have shown in the visual domain. And they are also compatible with classic tuning curves. So you have a best frequency of that neuron. You've got a certain latency. You can even extract temporal processing characteristics. So this is all nice. Of course, we would move to more realistic sounds, and people have done that. For example, if you say vocalizations, maybe from a kitten, are what interests us, why not mimic those with prototypic sounds that have similar qualities, like dynamic moving ripple stimuli shown here. So these are spectral temporal transients that move in a continuous fashion, semi-random fashion across time. Or ripple noise, which is similar to these tone pips, but more spectrotemporally distributed continuous values, which could mimic the babbling of some river or something like that. And for these stimuli, you can do the same thing that we have already done. Just compute the spike-triggered average. Always when an action potential occurs, take the stimulus window prior to that, average all those parts on top of each other, and again, you obtain qualitatively similar receptive fields. For example, here for anterior colliculus, Scalabrini and Schreiner also obtained excitatory and inhibitory bands in the spectral dimension, in the temporal dimension. So this would be a single band or a temporal modulation filter, if you wish. They also had more complex on-off patterns and also some of these diagonal patterns. What we see here as well is that these dynamic ripples, as compared to this ripple noise, seem to elicit more responses or stronger receptive fields, at least here in IC, in the same neurons for some of the ripple noise. For some neurons, there was almost no response for the ripple noise. So what we see here already is a significant dependence of the neuronal response in to different stimulus ensembles. Remind you, the linear part of our analysis here in this spectrotemporal field is always the same. So it says that even the linear characteristics change for different sound ensembles. And now we would like to do this, of course, also for fully natural stimuli, maybe.
Sorry, this was for ensembles or for individual neurons in some of these patterns?
These are four neurons from inferior colliculus. And they have been driven with an ensemble of these dynamic ripples and the ripple noise stimuli. So the receptive field patterns you see here are individualized for each neuron, but average across the entire stimulus ensemble.
That's in the IC, and would you see similar patterns in the cortex?
It's different, and we'll see more examples. Yeah. Now, when does this break down, this just simple spike-triggered average? Well, if we go to even more natural stimuli, like, for example, conspecific songs in birds, if we look at just the left-hand side, if we compute the spike-triggered average for the same unit driven with random tones, spike-triggered average on that, and the same neuron driven with conspecific bird songs, the spike-triggered average pattern looks considerably different. So different that you wouldn't say this is the same neuron. So what happens here?
Yes. What's the meaning of the positive time?
This is again spike-triggered.
Yes, it's right.
But, you're right here.
The piece of the spectrum that's yet to come.
Yeah, here, here it's obviously time reversed, right? Here, positive time was counted as prior to the spike, whereas negative.
Some have phase on both sides.
Yes, so you're having features on both sides.
But
one of them is in the future.
Yeah, exactly. For the spike triggered average, you're absolutely right. So where does this come from? The point here is that, for example, these bird vocalizations, conspecific songs here, contain strong correlations across time and across frequency. So what we are seeing here is also, for example, the temporal autocorrelation function of the stimulus envelope in positive and negative temporal directions. So that explains why even in this non-causal direction here, you can have significant influences if you just compute a spike-triggered average.
So it's really not a property of the neuron, it's more a property of the stimulus
Exactly.
Statistics, that the things that tend to cause that neuron to fire, the statistical properties of those stimuli, that they tend to be followed by something that is completely acausal with the with the firing of that cell.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't understand why that keeps happening from the random tones.
So this is a different tone ensemble than the previous one. So these must have been tones which also have had some autocorrelation function. I would need to look up the specifics.
These modulated noise sometimes that might have.
That could be. Yeah. So this is from Tunison. So you know, maybe you know these modulation patterns that Tunison always looks like, and thereby these autocorrelations would be introduced into the tone ensemble as well.
Just a really ignorant question. Could you please repeat how the spike triggered average goes into the computation of the STRF?
Yeah, so I haven't been here, so to speak, so far.
Okay. I had the same question.
You had the same. Okay. So this is.
Could this be a rebound from inhibition? So you see there's some activity, and then there's inhibition. And then there's more activity. Is it really just a representation of the
That's really.
Or is it really, could it be something in the neuron's response?
Yeah. So that's basically the crux of the where we are heading, where I'm heading, where the field heading. What is really part of the stimulus? What is part of your neuronal response? In general, I fully agree. It could be, in principle, it could be something inherent in the neuron. For this specific case, and then we get to the right-hand side, it's really just stimulus properties. It's really not anything that is in the neuron. Because if we compensate for these autocorrelation characteristics of the stimulus and factor that out of our spike-triggered average, then we arrive at receptive field estimates that are surprisingly similar, again, for the STRF from the random tones and for the STRF from the bird songs. So they are not exactly identical, but you would see a similar center frequency, similar on-off characteristics. So these make sense as being generated from the same neuron. So these are much closer to reflecting only our neuron characteristics and not the characteristics of our two different stimulus ensembles. And yeah, this is how Tunison, for example, drew it. This is what we are doing. We take the sound, we decompose it with a filter bank into bands of different center frequencies. We compute in each band the envelope and logarithm. And now we have to look at correlations, temporal correlations within each band, so to speak, autocorrelation function of the envelope in each band. And that's significantly non-zero for natural stimuli. And we also have to take into account correlations of the envelopes in different center frequency bands, so these crossterms. And all these stimulus statistics go into the covariance matrix of our stimulus ensemble. And for this, we have to.
Can I have a question back to that? The characteristic of the narrowband signal, the envelope, is that being taken after full wave or half wave rectification?
This would usually be, well, it doesn't make a big.
It turns out it makes a table difference. You either get right about how the ear works or it doesn't, because the auditory system always uses half-wave rectification. And when you smooth a full-wave rectified signal, you turn it into a phase-absent signal, and then it turns out to become a problem later.
Okay, but the envelope then also uses, so you have full or half-wave rectification, but then you also have low pass filtering in the temporal direction in order to get the envelope, and then it gets similar, but not identical. So we have to correct for these stimulus correlations, and that's what can be done, for example, with the normalized reverse correlation, where you first compute your spike-triggered average as before, which does include stimulus statistics influences, and then correct for all the second-order correlations in the stimulus ensemble by basically multiplying with the inverse of the stimulus covariance matrix. And if you do this, you're optimal in the sense that you're trying to minimize the squared error of your prediction with your STRF compared to the actual neuron response. So this is really in the Gaussian second order signal processing, statistical signal processing realm. Similar is our regression techniques, for example, ridge regression, where depending on which how we exactly do it, but basically we also compute the source covariance matrix, but add additional regularization terms that add terms on the diagonal of the covariance matrix, which basically has the influence of penalizing, I skip back slightly, of penalizing those parts of the spectrogram that don't contribute significantly to our receptive field. So those time frequency points that are close to zero would be penalized to go even more towards zero by techniques like ridge regression or other regularization methods. And these are, I would say, already pretty good and probably the standard methods that most labs would use.
But so in ridge regression, I wouldn't expect that the terms that, you know, I would still expect some part of that autocorrelation, for example, to survive, just be reduced, but not be fully at zero, right? Because regression isn't sparse, so yes, you penalize, but you still get
non-zero
coefficients, basically.
Yes, yes, yes. You can also use other regularizations like L1, which has the effect of setting anything to zero. That's not so. We tried L1, of course, as well, but our impression was that it is much too sparse in terms of the STRFs you get in order to be realistic.
There is a concern with these things that you kind of smooth, you get kind of broader tuning than the neurons actually have, because essentially you're attenuating any high temporal or spectral tuning, because those are the parts of the modulation power spectrum that are weak and natural stimuli. And so one concern, it came up in some of I know Frederick's work, where you ended up seeing big differences between narrowband noise receptive fields and natural sounds, but part of those differences are kind of reflected in what the prior is imposing on the STRF.
What could be in the priors? Could also be this point that you have linear and nonlinear response properties, right?
But there is basically this prior essentially works like a smoothness prior, so it makes things a little smoother.
Effectively, okay. But though there is no explicit spatial prior yet incorporated into them. There are also methods where you enforce spatial smoothness. In the standard ones, they're not in there yet.
You are still spike trigger averaging at the onset an arbitrary object like a spectrogram, which contains entirely arbitrary parameters that you decide on. So the spectrogram is something that you just choose, okay? You choose what bandwidth, you choose whether to make it a wavelet one, or you just choose the spectrum. And you're basing the entire analysis on that one choice.
Yes, so people do use different representations. We use gamma tone filter banks, for example, which are still a very poor model of what is happening in the auditory periphery, but maybe better than the spectrogram. What you can show, and Stephen has done quite some nice work on that, is that this, if you do it this way, it relates to Volterra kernels as well. So basing this on the envelope computation is equivalent under some assumptions to second order Volterra kernels. So that gives you at least some mathematical relation. But you are right. Your results will depend on which, on top of which representation you're using these methods. Absolutely, absolutely.
Has anybody tried, the spike triggered DCA methods that Fairhall and company? Instead of doing a spike triggered average, you take a spike triggered of PCA of the entire signal, and you then you get multiple modes out that contain multiple items in the decision.
I'll briefly mention spike triggered covariance. So it's just one of the subspace methods. But I'm not sure whether there is to the extent of results for auditory.
Well, I mean, so Tensio and Schreiner have done a lot of that. Craig Tensio, Schreiner and Tensio, Christoph Schreiner. There's a lot of debate about spike triggered covariance versus maximally informative dimensions, and they kind of are the same thing.
So that's where we are.
Can I ask a question? So why do people want to correct for stimulus correlations as opposed to just showing us stimulus that doesn't have correlations? Is it because of nonlinearities, or what's the main reason?
Yeah, that's basically it, right? I mean, we want to drive. So if you draw this, I always like drawing these matrix vector things like you have your stimulus matrix, which is S. Where you would have examples in this direction, and your dimensions, your stimulus dimensionality in that direction. Thanks. And then you project it basically on just a single vector. Here it's called H, which is a vectorized version of your receptive field. And that gives you your response vector, same number as stimulus examples, your spikes or your spike rate. You could say, okay, let's just go back to the first slide and present random tone pips, for example. They are spatially, temporally uncorrelated, and then you could do it. You would drive the neuron in a different way than with natural stimuli, right? If we use a wide stimulus matrix, here, the neuron would potentially respond in a different way than if you drive it with speech, for example. So what happens when you drive it with speech? You can always factor any non-white matrix. You can always write as a white matrix times a square matrix. Related to the cross covariance matrix, so that the whole stimulus ensemble here is non-white, maybe your speech stimuli, but if you use your spike triggered average, it actually implicitly breaks down your non-white stimulus statistics into the white part and the correlation part, and then your STA will return as your receptive field the product of these two matrices. So it will lump a part that was originally in the stimulus into its estimation of the response vector. And that's the problem here, right? You want to drive the system with natural signals, but you still want to retain only the characteristics of the neuron response. That's the whole.
But it seems that you want a system characterization for different stimulus samples. So the argument, as you said, the assumption is that the system will respond differently for an ensemble of white noise, unnatural stimuli to the one of natural stimuli.
Yeah.
So whatever estimate of the STRF that you find, are you saying that you cannot apply them back to, if you find the STRF from the natural stimuli, you want to be able to apply it to the non-natural stimuli?
Yeah, and you can't.
You cannot.
No, the prediction will be wrong.
Is that,
because the neuron would behave in a nonlinear way, right? Here we are fitting a linear model to one stimulus ensemble and the neuron's response to that. And if the neuron happens to respond in a different linear way to a different stimulus ensemble, then of course our or a model from derived from one stimulus ensemble will not apply to the other one. But that's more a problem of the neuron, not of this method per se. But that's our limitation we have to keep in mind. Yeah, you're right. So heading towards, so far we've been strictly in the realm of Gaussian estimation, so to speak. Anything underlying stochasticity of the stimulus ensemble was implicitly assumed to be Gaussian. How can we get to more natural stimulus statistics also in that respect, not only including correlations, but also including non-Gaussian elements? And that brings us to the linear, non-linear Poisson model and related approaches. So we have, again, our scatter plot where our black dots were all those stimulus examples that did not elicit a spike, and the white ones were those that generated a spike. Now let's assume we just project through this cloud in a specific direction, maybe the one drawn in here already, and look at the probability distributions or histograms as we move along this direction, or that's the one here. And in this projection direction, we see that the probability of a spike, of a stimulus amplitude projected onto that direction, so to speak, behaves like the black histogram here, whereas only taken for the spike part, so probability of conditional probability of a stimulus value given that it generated a spike, it's the histogram for the white points, which is, of course, by construction of this example, moved a little bit further out to the top left here or the right in that model. So from this, we can, by computing, for example, likelihood ratios, compute a posteriori probabilities of a spike being generated when we are given a stimulus with a specific projection value in this direction. And that we can already readily transform into a firing rate. And these are actually quantities that we can compute from our experimental data. And this we can see as an empirical estimate of this non-linearity that is taking us from the linear projection with the STRF that we have already looked at to the actual firing rate that the neuron is exhibiting in our experiment. And this is not a linear function, obviously, so somehow we would need to take into account also the non-linearity between our STRF projection and the actual neuronal firing rate. And that's exactly what people have done in the LNP model, where we combine a linear filtering stage with this nonlinear operation, and the nonlinearly computed firing rate is driving a Poisson process which randomly generates spikes. So that's really probably the standard model at the moment. The question, of course, is where do we get this projection direction, which is our STRF? Where do we get it from? Let's look at the entire processing chain, so to speak. We've got our stimulus, we've got our receptive field filters. These two combined are just the inner product of two vectors in a space with the dimensionality of our stimulus. From that, with the nonlinearity, we get the spike. And we have to optimize for our projection direction V. And this is what two of the methods that are used are, for example, generalized linear models, which have been around in statistics for a long time, and which reflect exactly this structure, a linear, multidimensional linear projection combined with a one-dimensional nonlinearity. So this is some technique that can be used, for example, by maximizing the likelihood under assumption of some prior distribution. So for example, a binomial distribution, either we generate a spike or we don't. Another nice approach is from Sharpie and Bialik, that we could say, let's search in this high-dimensional vector space for directions. Let me go one slide back. Let's search in this high-dimensional space for directions where our projection in in this direction preserves as much information as possible in an entropy, in an information theoretic sense, about whether the neuron was spiking or not. And that is usually done in a semi-parametric way, parametric because we have just a vector for the direction, but semi-parametric because the distributions are empirically evaluated. So that's the maximally informative dimensions approach. Maybe briefly going to the question about spike-triggered coherence. Do we have subspaces? And I'm mentioning this because it relates a little bit to speech recognition, where deep neural networks, etc., are in a way doing something similar nowadays. We could say that we have kind of a complex cell model where the neuron we record from is actually driven by two parts of a receptive field. And these two are combined after each, for example, squaring each of them and then adding them. So this would be a complex cell in the sense that it could be, to some extent, invariant with respect to spatial or spectrotemporal shifts, for example. And if we analyze such a higher order neuron with standard spike-triggered average receptive field analysis, we will largely not recover any of the mechanisms that this neuron is performing. So one way of trying to incorporate this anyways is going back to our spike-triggered average, not just computing the average of the stimulus windows prior to a spike, but the full covariance matrix. And then look at eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and that's relating perhaps to the question about PCA or singular value decomposition. And then we can indeed identify eigenvectors that correspond to the parts of the complex cell receptive fields that originally went into this. But this is more a side note for the sake of this presentation. Okay, so this is basically where we are currently in the flow of this tutorial. We've got our stimulus representation, we've got our spike trains, and we connect them with our linear, non-linear response model. So now we are coming a bit towards the work that we have done in one project together with biologists. One thing we thought is, okay, let's maybe drive the neurons with a slightly different stimulus, and Frank Ohl from Magdeburg, who has worked a lot on gerbils and on sound recognition, on sound perception in gerbils, was always intrigued by their sensitivity to formant-like structures, vowel-like patterns. So we came up with these transient spectrotemporal chirps, frequency-modulated tones. And the stimulus that we used for stimulating the gerbils and computing the STRFs were random superpositions of such frequency-modulated tones, either with different center frequencies, with different transients, either in a block design where every 100 milliseconds we would have a block of these chirps, or in an overlapping non-block design where the chirps would all overlap and there would be no coherent onset structure. And these stimuli, to the experience of our biologist collaborators, are really good in driving neurons, and in particular also cortical neurons. So we get really high, relatively high spike rates compared to, for example, DMR, moving ripple stimuli, when we use this stimulus ensemble. However, this is of course also a highly non-Gaussian stimulus ensemble that has strong correlations both across time and across frequency direction. So we would.
For this ensemble, how many neurons do the experimenters have, and what do they, how do they record them?
On the order of 50 neurons, I think we have. Basically, we are looking here at single unit recordings. Yeah, yeah. They have, as far as I understand, they have relatively high quality of the recording, but it's essentially a single channel. Yeah.
In this kind of stimuli, as well as Maria Geffen and I used synthetic water sounds, which we actually generated with drops, you can entirely bypass doing the averaging over the sonogram and just average over the theoretically infinitely thin line that you are generating there. So you have these perfect tones, okay, that are zero thickness in principle, okay, you controlled exactly their frequency. And in principle, you could simply do the spike-triggered average, you know, and then the covariance elimination by using that, which is what you're actually presenting, as opposed to this sonogram, which is only a representation of what you're presenting. Have you tried that?
We haven't tried sonograms, no. No.
But you see what I mean, right? I mean, yes. It's actually a set of perfect.
This would look very different in the sonogram representation that you showed us. They would just be individual lines. I understand your point.
Yeah, but actually, you know which lines you made.
Yes.
You know them because you generated. So you don't need to use either my sonogram or anybody else's sonogram.
Okay.
You know exactly what you put in the time frequency domain.
Yeah.
That's a mathematically perfectly defined line. So you could actually try that.
Yes, you're right. We haven't done it, but we thought about it. Yeah, it's okay. It. Here we have.
I would strenuously encourage you to try it.
It seems like there's sort of an empirical question there, right? Because what you could argue this is modeling the auditory nerve, right? So even if you have an infinitesimally thin.
Whether it's modeling or not, the other. Auditory nerve is a matter of interpretation. Right, as
right. I guess, are you arguing that there's only a single nerve fiber that's going to be carrying the sound?
No, what I'm saying is that here, the full analysis is based on doing a spike-triggered average of an object that you have chosen. Mm-hmm. One sonogram among infinitely many time-frequency representations. Right. On the other hand, you do have the actual representation of the object you gave, because you know mathematically the time-frequency lines that you use in generating these individual tones.
Okay, let me paraphrase.
Let me finish this. No, it's the same thing as if you were to say, Hubel and Bissell, okay, put some line over there, and then you take some arbitrary model of how you outfocus those lines, okay, to get some Gaussian thing, and you derive receptive fields from that. If your receptive fields happen to be smaller than the outfocusing, you're screwed. You don't see it.
So let me paraphrase, or maybe I'm over paraphrase. You're suggesting. Computing STRF about that says which of the objects, quote unquote, the neuron is attending to, whereas here, and that's what Stephen is also alluding to, are trying to infer what are the internal characteristics of the neuronal responses based on the perceptual representation and perceptual organization of the auditory pathway. And that could be two potentially very different things that we obtain. Yeah, but you're right. We are not based on sonograms and physically exact representations. We are based on a representation with gamma tone filter banks, where we say this is at least an approximation of what is represented on the auditory nerve at some stage. Yeah. But we, in a slightly different context, we actually thought for a slightly different experimental design, we thought about doing that, and it may very well make sense for depending on your question and on the experimental setting. Yeah, I agree. So one thing that we could do, and that's actually what the focus of our approach that we developed for the analysis of STRFs was. Do we really need to go to infer, for example, a spike rate as we had in the MID approach or in the generalized linear models, where we assume that a poor song process is driven by an estimate of our spike rate? Can we maybe go back one step and ask the question, the estimation question on an even more empirical level and say, well, we have an input stimulus, we have an output stimulus. The output stimulus happens to be just 0 and 1 numbers. Can you pose this as, for example, a classification question? That is, of course, a classical black box modeling approach. We actually use a support vector machine classifier at that point in time. The question is, can we interpret it? And if we use a linear classifier that we train just on prediction of spikes, yes or no, but not assuming any Poisson process, for example, then we can equally interpret the weights, the linear weights that are learned by this SVM classifier or other linear classificator as a receptive field again. And now the question is, does it give us useful receptive field estimates? So what we are doing here is, in this approach, is basically very similar to what we've seen before. We just take spectrotemporal patches out of our stimulus and group them by either those spectrotemporal patches that did elicit a spike, the red points here, or that did not elicit a spike. And then we fit, for example, a maximal margin classifier to those data and interpret the separation hyperplane here in terms of spectrotemporal receptive field pattern. And a nice thing here is that we can very well control regularization. So these SVMs, for example, but other methods would get similar results, are good to control in their easy control in their complexity. So driving these Mongolian gerbil neural synthesis, I think I see, if I'm not mistaken, driving them with our quote-unquote speech simulating frequency-modulated tone ensembles gives us receptive field estimates with our classification-based receptive field method that are quite compatible to what we've seen so far. So we get a clear center frequency, we get a small temporal shift relative to the spiking spike time point of between 10 and 20 milliseconds. We get some temporal context that can, well, depends on the unit, can vary. We get certain on and off characteristics, both in the temporal dimension as well as in the spectral dimension.
But this means in your recent diffusion, then there's no diagonal structure anymore, or what? Does it mean that we can describe the response to these sweeps, so to speak, in a way which is sufficient to account for temporal modulations and not spectral ripples, or not combined?
I will tell you, I will...
For years and years, people like Shia argue that we have these spectral temporal receptor fields, which in particular are there to cover the frequency sweeps. Mm-hmm. While I have never, in any modeling work, never needed anything like this. It was only sufficient to have the temporal events on correlation or so. So what are you saying here?
I would dare to say this is kind of solved or anything. So I would actually be interested in feedback from the audience, what your experience, so to speak, is. My point, where I'm heading towards, is that to our experience, though maybe you would call it somewhat anecdotal because we don't have thousands of cells or just on the order of 50 to 100 cells, in our anecdotal experience, we observe that whether you see patterns that are somewhat like diagonally shaped, like this one here, for example, it doesn't only depend on your stimulus ensemble and your neuron, but it seems to depend really crucially also on your estimation algorithm. So this classification-based method, which uses higher-order stimulus statistics, We compared it to a number of other methods. For example, rich regression. I will show more examples later. So this is really a just correlation-based method. Second-order statistics. And our qualitative observation is that these same four units, these receptive field estimates are comparable in a way. They are not completely different, so they are compatible. But in the details, they really seem to differ. So we see, we have in our examples, we have some examples where we would say, okay, this could be a diagonal inhibitory sideband, for example, or this could be a transient, a spectrotemporal transient, for example. We tend to see them only in the ridge. If we use our more sophisticated method, and I'll prove that statistically this method is better than that one, in our experience, many of these diagonal patterns disappear. So I don't think the question is settled, but my point is, use a good estimation algorithm before you make your judgment. That brings me to...
But what is, can you say, what is the essential aspect that's represented in the more accurate and the first version versus the rich? So why are you're saying this is more accurate
Yeah.
But what is the essential difference?
Yeah, it's actually the next, thank you, it's the next slide, so to speak. Higher order stimulus correlations. This is from a nice paper from Christensen, Manish Sahani and Jennifer Lin, where they investigated similar nonlinear response properties of neurons with an emphasis on the nonlinearity of the neuron, but I think it carries over to the stimulus ensemble. So if we drive our standard linear, nonlinear Poisson model, just a model neuron, no noise in here, well, just Poisson noise, but no other noise, just a simulation, really simple, nothing could be simpler. If we drive this simple model neuron with dynamic random chord, salt and pepper, so to speak, stimulus, standard estimation methods will obtain the correct estimated STRF given the spike train, the simulated spike train, and the stimulus ensemble. Correct, we obtain what we put in. What happens if we use stimuli that, to some extent, mimic what we see with these spectrotemporal transients in natural signals? Ripple stimuli. Just oriented ripples. Here we see one example of a ripple, but of course the stimulus set ensemble contained all possible ripples in all different directions with different spatial frequencies. Convolve this stimulus set with the same spectrotemporal receptor field, drives the same neural nonlinearity and Poisson process. Will we be able to recover no noise this receptive field from the relation between this input and that output using standard second order algorithms? Answer is no, we aren't, even in this very simple example. We get, qualitatively, we get the correct foci of the activation, but we get strong sidebands, artifacts that can only be due to our estimation method. And this is already correcting for second order correlations. So this is an example where higher order correlations that are introduced apparently influence the estimation result for the STRF that we are getting out. Can we observe something similar for more realistic data? So here we are driving also a simulation, but we are driving it with speech stimuli. So here we have a simulated receptive field, just on and off characteristics. Some nonlinearities for our neuronal nonlinearity, and we are driving the entire thing not with ripples but with human speech stimuli. And then we try to re-estimate with different methods, classification-based, receptive field, maximally informative dimensions, generalized linear models, and rich regression, whether we can find that true underlying receptive field again. And what we see is that no matter which nonlinearity we use, the more sophisticated methods, so to speak, CBRF, MID, GLM, they generally obtain pretty good estimates of our original receptive field. So our correlation coefficient for our method is between 0.89 to 0.99, Whereas the rich regression, for example, breaks down to a considerable extent for some non-linearities and gives us what we saw in the previous simulation, these strong side bands where the original receptive field is artificially broadened into other frequency bands and also across the temporal direction.
One question.
Yes.
What can you say about the structure of the residuals of these fitting procedures? Because that's where you're really gonna see. I mean, you're regressing a model to the data, okay? And you're minimizing over some measure of the in each one of these, you're minimizing, you know, the residuals in some model. Can you examine the actual residuals to check that they actually follow the statistics that you assumed, or you know, because in the case of the lower right hand corner over there, it would be very easy to look through the residuals of the fitting and realize that all of a sudden, you know, I mean, there are frequencies that appear to respond there, okay, and many other times when there is a frequency present there, the receptive field just doesn't respond.
Yeah, it was, so you mean the error term, so to speak, as it evolves across?
Yes, in all of these regression methods, okay, you are minimizing mathematically some measure of the residuals.
So
you
here,
always want
to
go back and take a look at the residuals to see how they look like, because if all of the errors are concentrated on 17 residuals, then you know that there is some.
Yeah, one could
something
think,
you got seriously wrong, right? You see what I mean?
One could think about it. You would need to either you would need to summarize it in some statistical quantity, which we have done here. So this implies the residual error as well. Or you could hope that anecdotally you find points where things go wrong and then come up with a better something, better method or whatever. Yeah, would be yeah. I don't know how much one could expect to see here, but in a way you could say, well, that's what we are doing here, right? If you look at the difference of the true versus the estimated, what we clearly see is this spectral broadening.
At the residual, but you don't have the original in reality, okay? So if you're looking at the experimental data, you don't have that original abstract receptive field. So how are you going to diagnose whether your regression is good or not, other than by seeing where is it that my regression is missing, is seriously missing the mark?
Mm-hmm. So for the reason, so maybe you could...
One problem with having looked at this sort of thing a little bit, one issue is that natural sound speech have correlations in spectral axis, and so probably that bottom right model will actually predict similarly to the upper right model, just because basically there's not a lot of high spectral narrow band energy in the stimuli, and because basically that sort of vertical smear is reflecting correlations that exist in the stimulus. Although we could test it with another stimulus that doesn't have those correlations, then you can see the error come out. So that monitor.
So what are you saying? Just because there are these stripes and because there are these correlations, is then more plausible?
And there's kind of a fundamental ambiguity because speech contains correlations.
Right.
If you have enough data, you can eventually say what's driving this response. But in sort of finite data conditions, it's actually very hard to attribute a specific spectral channel to the response just because the correlations are strong. So it isn't quite as simple as just looking at the residuals. But if you get enough data, then...
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, our hypothesis why these, I call them artifacts, exist is because they are somewhat present in the stimulus ensemble. For example, like wide band onsets across many bands, much beyond second two-point correlations, but really correlations along the full spectral axis, that these give rise to those patterns here. And as Stephen says, if we go back to the stimulus, we would probably see that at the same time instances, these are either relevant or not relevant, because if we feed a wideband onset stimulus through this filter, it will give us a similar response than feeding it through this filter, right? So it's really a bit difficult to disentangle.
But why didn't you know what filter is so much better than classification based? Why does it not suffer from the same problem?
Because it's not inherently based on second order statistics. Rich regression is really just looking at 2-point correlations. Whereas all the other methods, CBRF, MID, GLM, depending on how you, for example, how you choose your priors in the GLM method, you implicitly take into account also higher order multi-point correlations. Now that's why I'm saying move to higher order methods.
You can sort of, so CBRF is done, sort of executed in an SVM classifier framework, but I mean, you can, in a sense, it's a gradient-based method.
Sure.
That's kind of like what GLMs use.
Yes.
So I guess you can say that you found a prior or cost function that somehow does a better job dealing with these different.
Yeah. Yeah. So the cost function or the error function of the support vector machine is this hinge loss, right? Where you have zero loss on one side of the on the correct side, so to speak, of your separation plane, and a linear loss on the other side. Whereas if you use a purely Gaussian method, it will use a squared loss. So these methods are similar in the sense that they use a linear projection, but they differ in the assumed stimulus statistics. Or response statistics model that's underlying. So it's really different cost functions, so to speak, that we are optimizing here, whether it's just squared error or whether it's something like hinge loss, which cannot be summarized as just second-order polynomial, right?
I mean, the difference, I mean, to your comment, also, the difference are not huge, huh? Or what? As between when I look at that, yes.
The ridge ones are not a bad approximation.
Right.
I would say that...
So yes, reasonable or not? Or would you say it fails?
No. Let's look at some examples of real data, right? and I have I'll zoom into some of the diagonal patterns, so to speak. So this is real units from the inferior colliculus driven with our FM bank stimuli. And there we see, again, on the first qualitative level, I think they are compatible. One wouldn't say these are worlds apart. All methods give us comparable center frequencies. All methods give us comparable temporal offsets. All methods give us some temporal processing characteristics. And, yeah, we do see some spectral processing characteristics here. They're all present in all of them. I think the question is more, how is it in the details, right? Because when you want to ask or answer Torsten's question, is it, are we faced with purely temporal and purely spectral processing in the auditory system, or do we really have these diagonal transient patterns? That is something that is going to finer levels of detail, right? And that's what we try to anecdotally also look here at here for the real neuron responses. And that's there we see, as I've already pointed out, maybe let's turn it off. There we see, again, characteristic differences between the two methods. So here I've only contrasted classification-based versus rich, because they are, so to speak, the opposite points of the spectrum that we have seen in the previous slide. And again, our FM bank stimuli were, compared to dynamic moving ripples. And what we see is that rich regression gets these diagonal patterns to some extent here, and maybe you could also see it here. You can argue about it for our FM code complexes, relatively natural stimuli with strong transients. But same rich regression method, same neuronal units, does not get these transients for the dynamic moving ripples. Whereas the classification-based method does not get these transient I would say not at all. I don't really see them present in these receptive field estimates. And the CBRF method is also more consistent across the two stimulus sets. So I would argue that the SDRF estimates derived for the FM tone complex stimuli and the DMR stimuli are relatively similar. So we don't have such a large divergence from here to there as compared for the ridge method. So that's why what I think reinforces the point that on the finer level of details, you really have to be careful that statistical higher order properties from your stimulus set or from different stimulus sets are not leaking into your receptive field calculations, estimations.
What do you think, maybe naive question, but now we have in the stimulus these sweeps, and as people typically argue that these frequency sweeps that are kind of represented in these receptive fields, which represent these transitions. Okay, now let's say there are no representation at that level representing these sweeps there. How is then, let's say, is it then represented at earlier processing stages, so still kind of following as new activity following the instantaneous frequency already briefly, and then so process in parallel to these, or is there a correlation process later on? So I'm asking myself now. Now you find these patterns despite the strongly sweeping input, let's say. So how is this information represented if it's not represented in these receptive fields?
I mean, you can, in principle, basically you can encode spectro-temporal transients in different ways. You can have, so to speak, a direct feature extractor that is really looking for on one of the lower or first levels for spectro-temporal transients, maybe in terms of these pattern matching things. You could also do that on a much higher level, where you could have neurons that respond if one of the lower level neurons with some center frequency is first activated, and at some random time instance later, another unit with a different center frequency. That would, for example, be how hidden Markov models in speech recognition could encode transients implicitly.
And I would argue that at some point, if you teach an animal to differentiate an FM tube going up and the same tube going down, then at some point in the system, there must be one cell that allows for a linear decoding of it so that the animal can make a decision one way or the other. You don't agree?
Well, what if it's just measuring changes in the slope of the sweep, and what you've given it is the most extreme possible example?
So there is a neuron that measures the slope, is what you're saying?
I'm just saying they could measure the slope, but you don't have to do it with having a single cell that does that.
Well, I'm saying that eventually, if what you need to do is to move a muscle in one condition and move a different muscle in another condition.
That's a very good point, and it raises one of the fundamental questions in auditory research. There's a huge difference between causing a response and controlling the content of a perception.
Okay.
Well, that's where our problem lies. For all we know, there's no relationship between a spike and a perception. That's not been demonstrated. All we know is going all the way back to Sherrington, responses are controlled by spikes going from sensory motor systems. We have no clue about what it is that goes from the activity of the brain to the perception, and I'm worried about that because you don't see it. I have to worry about it because it might be so
long.
But I mean, also another, maybe it's wrong, but for example, FM is often transformed into AM in the audio system due to all the bandpass filtering. You have certain rates that are kept, but if it's fast, it's transformed into AM processing. So I think it's maybe you're right. There are cells that are just sensitive, but maybe it's also something else, or that there's some transformation before that and then.
And I guess my argument is that this is only one part of the brain. And we're trying to assign every possible function to this set of cells. That's a little much.
Sure.
the information is in the population.
That's true, but on the other hand, these SRTFs are used for so many studies to represent everything, and then argued, okay, we need this information, these spectral temporal receptor fields with these diagonal structures. And of course it works because it represents all information. I mean, you have these base functions and what it does because of all information. But what does it have to do with the neural representation? And so I don't know. I'm not satisfied with it. It's interesting. The first time, this is interesting. I mean, I would like to see how far we can go. And this is in the IC. So would you argue it's probably similarly?
You said that there are differences in the cortex.
Yeah, so maybe I'll get to that, yeah. But at least in terms of variability. So let me see. I don't claim I make any attempt to answer your question. My point here is simply to make the point that your result depends also on the finer details, if you will, of your estimation method. And if you see something in a picture, it doesn't really necessarily mean that it's really a property of the neuron. Maybe let me give you two more slides about this method. One is a quantitative comparison. So I have shown you pretty anecdotal evidence so far. But let me show that quantitatively, in terms of information transfer rate, so how much of the spike non-spike information is retained in our estimates. What's the mutual information between that the stimulus still carries about the response in our model? How is it compared for the different method? And that's what we compared here. For the same stimulus ensemble, averaged across a set of on the order of 50 neurons for the FM sleep stimuli. And what you see is that the spike triggered average by far has the lowest amount of information retained in the model, for obvious reasons that I've started out with. If we go to the normalized reverse correlation method or to ridge regression, they are significantly better than the SDA method. But if we compare these second order method to this group of higher order estimation methods, MID, GLM, CBRF, then we see that all these more sophisticated higher order methods are significantly better in terms of information transfer compared to the second order methods. We actually do not find a statistical difference in the performance of these three methods here among each other. So on that level, they are statistically equivalent despite of small, it's just a small trend that you see here. What we also looked at, and that might be relevant, and other people have looked at similar things, relevant for experimentalists, is the question, how much data do we need in order to reliably estimate a receptive field filter? And this we compared again for rich MID, GLM, and CBRF. And we said, let's just reduce our training size. So we have our full training data set, that it would be 100%. And let's make it successively shorter and see whether we retain the receptive field estimate that we obtain with the full data set, whether we retain that also when we feed the algorithm only with smaller parts of our data set. So think about your ongoing biological, physiological experiment. You want to know right away what's the receptive field estimate for that neuron that I'm recording from at this moment. And in fact, Anne Meyer has, together with Jan Diepenbrock, implemented that right on the side of the people in Magdeburg who are doing the recordings in order to quickly get an estimate. And what we see is rich estimation, the gray ones, it's actually not that bad. It's moving pretty quickly up, but it has quite some estimation variance. So these are cross-validated results, which also give us an error estimate. If we look at maximally informative dimensions, they have the problem probably that they are trying to fix too many parameters. So they really need a decent amount of data in order to get a reliable estimate, because it's a semi-parametric method. And yeah, GLMs, the black ones, and classification-based approach, the right, the rate, rate points, they work pretty nicely, I would say. What we like in particular about our method, the rate curve, is that it has relatively small variance of the estimator. So it converges relatively quickly compared to some of the others to the optimum. And the variance of our estimator is also the smallest. So that points to good regularization properties of these SVMs. Okay. That's basically what I would say about this method. We have one other study, which I probably wouldn't have mentioned, but I like to show one slide. It's on different data with a different algorithm, but it's also looking at the question, how many units do we see that exhibit temporal versus spectral versus spectral-temporal characteristics. And there we looked at some publicly available data on one of these neuroscience data repositories from Saravuli. That's the zebrafinch localization data, and we analyzed it with rich regression to get the receptive fields, and then performed a matching pursuit analysis of the receptive field. So you get your receptive field with center frequency, some spatial or spectral extent with on-off patterns, whatever, for a couple of hundred cells, I think that was. And now we are asking, can that receptive field be explained by specific basis function combinations? And here we used matching pursuit with Gabor basis functions. Why did we use Gabor basis functions? Well, we used them because they contain exactly what we're interested in. Temporal modulations in terms of on-off patterns in the temporal direction with different modulation frequencies with different time constants. Same along the spectral axis, so this would be Gabor patterns that are sensitive for purely spectral modulations. And they also contain the diagonal, so to speak, basis functions where we have joined spectro-temporal modulations. And they contain this in a nicely parameterized manner. So if we analyze first our receptive fields with matching pursuit, and the matching pursuit takes these Gabor basis functions as atoms, as the dictionary, then we can afterwards look at how often did the matching pursuit select purely temporal basis functions, how often did it select purely spectral basis functions, and how often did it select truly spectral-temporal basis functions. So kind of a proxy way of quantifying the spectral-temporal characteristics of an ensemble of neurons. And the results are shown here on the right-hand side. What is plotted here are, with the size of the circles, the weights that the matching pursuit is giving to individual Gabor atoms, averaged across the entire stimulus data set, across the entire, receptive field data set that we, across the receptive fields that we estimated. And what we see is that along this axis here, corresponding to the purely temporal modulations, we see a lot of Gabor atoms that are used in this direction with relatively high weighting factors. In the purely spectral direction, this one here, we see that there's also quite a bunch of purely spectral Gabor functions being selected. In the truly spectrotemporal quadrants here and here, the density of basis functions selected for those Gabor components is comparably low. So we don't see that that many of those. So from this, we can at least say that in the sheer number of patterns selected with matching pursuit, the temporal and the spectral direction seem to dominate the joint spectrotemporal directions. But it's more a variance, an energy argument. It says that these are present more often and stronger. It doesn't say anything about their behavior or significance, whether they are significant to for detecting some sounds, for example, for the animal or anything. That is not covered in these data.
Say again, this matching the pursuit analysis. What how did you do that? So you correlate.
So let's say you have we have an underlying spectrotemporal receptive field, which has, I don't know, maybe some center here and some off components on there. Then what we do with our matching pursuit method is first we find the focus, so to speak, where in after temporal and spectral shifts is the focus of our activation in the receptive field. And then we ask ourselves, can we model this empirical receptive field pattern here by one or two or three of these basis functions?
What was the input? What was the data, so to speak?
The data was from zebra finches, and interestingly, the stimulation was bird songs.
But what specific songs? What is the distribution of, say, actual spectrotemporal? So when you say you don't observe them so much, does it really happen in the stimuli?
If you believe the theory behind spectrotemporal receptive fields, the rationale is that it should be in the neuronal response characteristics. So if that's what we are specifically trying to do, this abstract from the stimulus ensemble and only cover the neuronal response characteristics. Surely there are spectral, temporal, and spectrotemporal variations in these birdsong data. We are trying, or the SDRF analysis is of course trying to get only at the neuronal response characteristics. And on top of the estimated neuronal response characteristics, we are trying to characterize those in terms of their spectral, temporal, and joint spectral temporal modulation characteristics.
So, the horizontal axis here in your plots, in the spatial temporal plots, is time, and the vertical one is a frequency. So whatever is horizontal or vertical depends on what is the bandwidth of your analysis. If you change the bandwidth of the filter that you use in your sonogram, something that appears horizontal will become vertical and vice versa. Okay, so and that.
Well, you would have scaling of the time axis and scaling of the frequency axis, but
yes,
you couldn't transform something purely temporal into something purely.
If you have a short circlet, okay, a short Gaussian envelope tone, and you analyze it with a bandwidth, okay, with a temporal bandwidth that's longer and frequency bandwidth that's sharper, it will appear as a vertical line in a sonar. If you analyze it with the opposite thing, it will appear as a horizontal line. So the quotient between these horizontal gabors and vertical gabors, okay, is actually given. You will have a flow as you change the underlying bandwidth of your analysis. Now, that bandwidth in the case of the ear is presumably frequency dependent.
Okay, but that brings us back to the previous question, right? Here we are really relying on a model of the first auditory processing stages, and we are building on top of that. But you're right. If we assume a completely different model for the basilar membrane functioning, for example, what you say could happen.
A completely different model, yeah. okay, I'm sorry to harp on it, but there are infinitely many different time frequency representations which are all correct. And you have chosen one of them.
Yes, you're right.
Okay?
You're right.
And, you know, and therefore the entire analysis contains parameters which are arbitrary. In this particular case, one is very obvious. If you change the bandwidth of your sonogram, things that appear horizontal will become vertical. So you're distinguishing here, you're saying, I have this temporal characteristic or spectral characteristics. Well, that depends on the bandwidth of analysis, whether it's temporal or...
Yes, but typically the temporal modulations that occur, let's say they are to be between a couple of hertz and let's say 100 hertz, or fundamentally, and typically the analysis in the periphery, whatever it is exactly, that does not resolve.
Here we're talking songbirds, okay? So, you know, what yeah. exactly, I mean, the temporal characteristics of modulation in the 500 hertz range of their hearing and in the 4 kilohertz are not the same, okay?
No, that's true.
So maybe...
But I would agree that okay. some kind of constant Q, or I guess this is a reasonable assumption, and then...
You have to start somewhere. So here we have basically used this standard model.
The difference between vertical and horizontal is marked by a parameter that you imposed in your analysis.
Yes, although... Yes,
okay,
well, we chose some standard.
If you change that thing, it thinks that around your horizontal line will go into the vertical line. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah, but that's, so to speak...
You know, I do agree that diagonal things are intrinsically diagonal. I do agree with you, okay, but the things that are either horizontal or vertical, that would change if you change the analysis.
Yes, so we have taken here standard peripheral auditory processing models for granted, so to speak, but if we change the first analysis stage, sure, many things could happen.
You might be able to discriminate by looking at the borders, no, of the... For the intensity peak, I think Marcel was right, but if you look at the inhibitory length, you could still discriminate whether they're in frequency space or in time space, like in time direction. Or you just stretch the one, then you still get the inhibitory flanks on the left and right, while for the horizontal ones you get a top and bottom.
So, okay, you could say we would need to match the Gabors here to basically Marcello's remark. Mm-hmm. But those interfere. That's correct, and we are, as I said, we haven't optimized here for the peripheral processing. We've just taken it for granted as a standard model. So it's not any exotic choice that we have made. It's just something which you just need to agree upon. And if you change that part, of course, these analyses could change as well. That's clear. Yeah.
If you just look at the picture, these are zebra pictures, right? The birds. If you just look at the picture, you would say, well, this animal really likes to tell the difference between sounds that have different temporal modulation rates. And it doesn't care quite so much in the frequency structure of the signal. Now, birds are known for their ability to hear fast and slow, to do modulation rate discrimination very well. And bird song signals typically are highly differentiated in terms of temporal modulation rate. I don't know what statistically it's like in terms of spatial separation of harmonics and so forth. But it might be interesting to do the same thing with the data from the gerbil. And the reason for that is because there's pieces that you really need to get for the gerbil. And somebody's going to have to go to the place where gerbils came from on the assumption that the lab gerbil in the United States doesn't have an auditory system designed to listen to United States sounds in rooms, that they're really designed to live to, in terms of what's in the Gobi Desert, which plus the sounds of other gerbils, of which there are several types. And it may turn out to be really important that these animals are intended to listen to different modulation rates. A gerbil lives in a world where, except for two gerbils, but something like that, all of it is random noise, and you're not going to get much internal correlation
sounds, because they're living in a place that the average sound level is about 5 dB SPL, unless it's raining or snow or wind. We need to know that.
So for gerbils, one of our collaborators, Frank Ohl, he has worked a lot on gerbils and has shown with biological experiments, so really in the system, so to speak, that they're remarkably sensitive to vowel-like vocalizations, even human vowels, which is why we think that these frequency-modulated tones for the gerbils really should make sense, and the neurons respond really strongly to them. I'm not the birdsong specialist, referring to these data, so I cannot really say much as to the relevance of purely spectral or purely temporal repetitions, for example. I have to say I was a little bit surprised that there are so few spectrotemporal points showing up here, because those are in the stimulus set. In the stimulus ensemble, you do have these. In birdsong data, you have these strong transients. So I would have expected more to show up here.
This is a different. I think you mentioned it. It'd be interesting to between species and also between area comparisons with this type of analysis.
They're
not emerging until the next processing stage.
Yeah.
So Sarah's data, she has data from Field Bell that you can probably run through the same analysis.
To really answer the question, one would need to perform similar analyses, hopefully also with slightly different algorithms, on a larger variety of data. But empirically, I would say this is the question as to how strong, at least how much these different kinds of modulations are represented in receptive fields. That should be a question that can be answered empirically to a good extent. It's not something that is up in the air, but there's lots of data available, and it would be amenable to analysis to at least partially answer this data, this question. I agree.
We are already in overtime.
Yeah.
Maybe wrap up.
So this is basically my last slide. I had another part about adaptation, but I'll just skip that one. So this is the summary here. So these are just the points I've already made a couple of times, but so we shouldn't just use rich regression. Go beyond rich regression whenever you can. I do think that our anecdotal evidence already shows that finer qualitative characteristics can indeed be influenced by also the finer qualities of your estimation algorithm. We really like these FM bank stimuli because we think they are relatively realistic, quote unquote, and they really drive IC and cortical neurons really well. I would say this is on the anecdotal side, that we see these joint spectrotemporal receptive fields not that often, and they do seem to, quote unquote, disappear whenever we use more sophisticated estimation algorithms. But I would say this is anecdotal evidence, a tendency. I wouldn't say this is for sure. More studies can be done, but that's the tendency I would say we see in the data. Okay, thank you.
Do we have some more questions, or do we have
the ferret auditory cortex? I thought there was a lot of slow frequency sensitive temporal modulation
tuning
response.
Tuning.
Yes.
There's more than Zieber-Finch MLD, but there's actually quite a bit on the cardinal axes.
Yeah, that's right.
Well.
The point here is to what extent is it just because you use harmonic restructured stimuli or something like that? This is interesting.
Yeah. Well, so you see it with ripple noise, right. and even with sort of clouds of tones and stuff. But I think, so Shihab's model shows a nice uniform tiling, right? And it's just you you get a few, occasionally you get a cell that's like way out there in that kind of nice narrow tilted position, but
he always argues that he has seen it. It's strong, I mean, this diagonal.
Neuron, but it's sort of like dolphins, right? There's one neuron that...
Is it at all a function of where you measure, whether you look in IC or A1, or is that not...
A1 is much more diverse, so we also look at variability of receptive fields, and there it's, you can really quantify that A1 is much more flexible, mm-hmm. adapting whatever than IC. That would have been sort of my second part. We haven't done these types of analysis systematically on different areas, but I agree. Or you would even expect that there should be qualitative differences in the processing, and my hope would be that it can be captured in some parametric way to some extent in order to fundamentally compare different processing regions. And maybe then it turns out in some regions you don't have it and in others you do have it, maybe. I don't know.
And the portable recordings you're referring to, what species, and anesthetized or awake?
These were all anesthetized.
What species?
Gerbils. Gerbils. Yeah.
So it's just that there's some fluctuation in the level of anesthesia that could introduce
Sure. Yes, actually, that would be expected. But still, we see more variability in A1 than as compared to.
But A1, the cortical neurons are more susceptible to anesthesia than.
And what would you say, anesthesia then introduces more
well, it can
stronger
just,
variability and.
Well, it can quiet the neurons, and then the animal's state of anesthesia is. Fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to have like absolutely constant, and body temperature may change. I mean, there are things that could influence the neural.
I'm not.
Even the kind of anesthesia will completely change responses.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I always, I'm not the biologist, so I always forget those details, but we can look up the specific way of how the anesthesia was. But I completely agree with you. I don't do the experiments, but from so to speak, the far distant perspective, I completely agree, yes.
Can I ask a more general question about what we want to use this characterization for, and how do we tell if one particular characterization or method is good or not? So I could imagine that either if it gives a really nice looking basis, then we're like happy. Like, hey, look, it tiles the whole space and all that. Or if it can make good predictions about the firing of specific neurons for things we haven't measured yet, then okay, that's a good one. Or if it can actually tell us what is the stimulus that would allow us to drive the neuron the strongest. What do you think is the best method for comparing these, or the best criterion for comparing these methods to see which one is the actual appropriate characterization of these receptive fields?
I don't know. Well, what I've proposed or the methods or the quantifications we used here is something like information transfer, or here, how often are any of these Gabor atoms used in matching pursuit. These are all technical measures, right? They are often influenced by just variance, signal power, so to speak. And as I already mentioned, that does not necessarily have to correlate with behaviorally relevant signal components. So if you go to a detection task for an animal, maybe things would turn out differently, and the animal would use quote unquote feature detectors that would only light up very dimly on these technical measures. So that really depends a lot on the question you're asking.
And I guess you also point out to
the ultimate goal would be relevance for behavior, but that makes things of course more difficult.
Yeah, I think a good point you raised was also the consistency across different stimulus ensembles. So if a method is consistent across different ensembles, then you trust it more than the others.
Yeah.
And any ideas from anyone else as to why you characterize? So I know from Stevens, for example, he wants to characterize the receptive fields of these cells because he wants to see how it changes when the animal is performing a task versus not. Mm-hmm. And the methods seem to be sufficient. Even if it's just a linear component of it, it seems to be sufficient to show differences when the animal is focusing on the task versus not. Is that Is that a good part?
Yeah, and there is no right way to do it in a sense, but at least you control for whatever you're doing wrong in the conditions that you're comparing, right? So if you want it, and that's at least the kind of control that you can provide. But I'm a big advocate of prediction accuracy, right? So if your model can predict arbitrary responses to arbitrary stimuli, then you've got a good model, right?
And in this case, you're thinking of neural responses to a particular, to an arbitrary stimulus, and not so much what is the stimulus that produces the strongest response.
Yeah. Well, I guess I sort of see that as one point in a very large stimulus space, and what if you want to really characterize everything about the cell, you want to be able to predict, you know, what stimuli modulate activity the most, right? You know, so Fisher information, you know, if you're on the slope of the tuning curve, maybe there's more interesting stuff happening. But prediction kind of encompasses that to some degree.
Can I ask a question of everybody, essentially? I don't know a single D1 neurophysiologist who does not believe at some level that the characterization of B1 neurons, okay, in terms of receptive fields, are at some level mechanistically correct. Namely that there are, you know, these connections, that it comes from actual connections coming from LGN, that has this shape, etc., etc. So they have this picture in which the underlying physical reality of the receptive field is, you know, is somehow implemented into hardware. Okay? What is your and everybody else's feeling with respect to whether SDRFs are actually the mechanistically correct explanation of what's happening, or whether they are just a characterization of a system that we don't really understand that much? Because in order to be able to sum a frequency here, a frequency there, you know, at different times, I need delay lines, okay, different tonotopic things, etc. And you would have a mechanistic picture of how that is carried out. Okay, so especially given the fact that you've shown us all these problems and estimations and inconsistencies in how it changes when you change the ensemble, do you believe that at some level SDRFs are mechanistic and in the truth?
No, I think it's a really bad model.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter whether you're in biology or purely technical applications. Linear models can take you so far. They are so simple, and they can take you so far. But they are wrong. Most of the time, they are wrong. So I like, for example, subspace models or hierarchical organizations. I think we could capture some plausible effects also with those and still retain relatively simple models. Maybe that's something. But
The deeper you go in the processing, the less relevant this should be. I mean, you get much more, I mean, the combinatorial complexity of your potential inputs is highly increasing.
Well, I know, but, you know, I mean, we're comparing homologous places, okay? We're comparing, you know, visual neurophysiologists doing A1, you know, you could say that B1, you could say that A1 is effectively higher in the hierarchy because it's the brainstem processing is more sophisticated than LGN. Okay, I'm pretty sure that an LGN neurophysiologist would like to disagree, but you know, I think we could agree on that. Okay, but still, you know, they're vaguely, you know, but you know, what does a neuron in A1 do in order to do its job? Okay, it's to me a much more mysterious question than what, you know, visual people tell you. You know, well, I have a V1 neuron here, okay, and it has these connections to LGN, and you have all of these centers around things, and I make a combination of these, and I get this receptive field. And then I have the extra classical receptive field, which is where contextual modulations are multiplicative, and they have it all, you know, they present it to you as though they have it all figured out, you know. We are talking about A1, and I have no clue what A1 is doing or how it does its job. I personally, you know, I mean, it's my limitation probably, right? But, you know, I mean, what, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like these SDRFs are a model that's amenable to a mechanistic, underlying mechanistic interpretation in some sense. Right.
Maybe I agree. Yeah. I mean, it's also, I think it's of course true that we look in physiology, you look at these structures and try to find eventually also correlates to perception. I can only say from a perceptual point of view, where some of the perceptual modeling has been inspired by physiology. For example, let's say cochlear, as a cochlear frequency selectivity, But also AM tuning. I mean, there has been evidence in IC and later on that there is AM tuning in various species. And from a perceptual point of view, I've tried to characterize this by using masking. Well, you can say, using masking, what does this tell us about the physiological circuitry? Probably nothing, but maybe a little bit. So there I can just say that I know from that work, from also physical arguments, there must be some decomposition of envelopes. So there is this envelope, the temporal envelope decomposition, a filter bank, or however we describe it. This must be there, because otherwise there's no way to account for a number of very basic perceptual masking detection experiments. So then the next step, because I'm struggling with the STRF, I have tried to, I mean, also via discussions with Shriha, but many others, there's always this concept of two-dimensional filters then, going to the spectral domain as well. And I can only say, so far, in tons of experimental conditions, including speech modeling, speech perception modeling, even though I agree it's a complex stimulus, it's difficult to understand, but never ever, I mean, the only thing, I never needed this specifically spectrotemporal as a combination, it's two-dimensional space, particularly not the diagonal.
Yeah.
I never, and I tried to figure out what the hell, why don't I don't need it. The only thing what's needed, you need some kind of, because speech is so structured across frequency, you need some correlation across, you need some across frequency analysis. But this could be a simple correlation, not necessarily a complex two-dimensional representation as the Scarbo function, whatever. So I can only say, I think it's crucial to look at all the physiological aspects, the mechanisms, this is crucial. So, because this inspires so much also in terms of behavioral aspect, particularly in relation to humans. But I cannot, so far I struggled, I don't need that, so this explicit representation here. So for me, it's interesting to see that you show that there's kind of dominance of the temporal amplitude modulations and less focus on this spectral ripple representation. But I don't know either. So I think it's inspiring, these concepts, but I can only say from my experience, it has been difficult to really use that or to I didn't need it to explore behavioral data in people. But it's in contrast to what Shihab says. So because he says, turn the musical pitch and all that, this is represented in these spectrotemporal creatures, and maybe that's right. I don't know.
Not to this like high level discussion. I have one basic question too. Have you ever tried to? So you said people look at correlations within the stimulus side. You could also look at the correlations within the output side of the spikes. So you take into account the time passed by since the last spike or something like this, and have an extra condition on your receptor field. Do you see like strong dependencies there?
Okay. Yeah. Two answers. One is if you believe in the poor song. Assumption, it's all in the rate, so there would be, should be no. But there are these spike response models, for example, that basically use time since previous spike. So they couple the timing of your previous spike back into your estimator. And for, I'm not, probably Stephen knows better how much they buy you in the auditory domain. For retina processing, they give you a significant performance boost.
That's what we
trained.
All right, I would say we take the opportunity and thank the speaker again.
Is this only a subset?